platform, blah, blah, blah. The Hollywood Reporter writes, since launching Trump's Truth Social and its parent company, the Trump Media and Technology Group, took in $3.7 million in net sales and lost tens of millions of dollars. These are the first financial details. When putting aside the value of the derivative liability, the company has lost $60 million since launching. If you include the value of the derivative liability, it's a loss of $31.5 million. This is a stunning, stunning implosion. And the takeaway for me is that a free speech platform for its own sake is very lame. They love promoting these platforms as this is a platform for regaining your free speech. First of all, what free speech have you lost? And it turns out that those who want to use speech simply to say, I have speech, often want to say either really horrible or really mundane, uninteresting things that nobody cares about. And that's what's happening on Truth Social, where even Donald Trump's engagement numbers are a humiliating slice of a sliver of what they were when he was on Twitter. Now, hilariously, losing 70 million is kind of better than Twitter's doing, in the sense that since Elon Musk bought Twitter and turned it into the cesspool that is X, it's lost over $20 billion in value. At least Trump's Truth Social has only lost 70 million in actual money. And we can add this to the very long list of failed Trump businesses: Trump Steaks, Trump Airlines, Trump Vodka, Trump Water, Trump Mortgage, Trump Magazine, Trump University, Trump Ice, the Trump Taj Mahal. By the way, how you can lose money with a casino actually takes some skill. So I don't know if Truth Social will continue to be artificially propped up. I don't know if Truth Social will ultimately close and fail, but it is really not going well. By the way, speaking of free speech, you know how these right wingers insist all the social media platforms are for the left? We're being silenced. We're not allowed to speak. We're not allowed to do this. We're not allowed to do that. Facebook has now completely shut down the David Pakman Show's monetization. And I really need your help making a contact at Facebook. Facebook makes it impossible to contact a real person. Let me tell you, we're on the left. We don't do hate speech. We don't do misinformation. We don't do medical misinformation. We don't do any of it. We started noticing a month ago that our Facebook revenue was down 95%. There was no real reason for it. Just none of the videos are getting views. None of the videos are monetizing 95%. We try to reach out to Facebook. It's form responses. Can't find anything. Not clear what it is here that is going on. Almost like we were shadow banned on Facebook. And then this morning, I log in and it says restricted monetization with a big red X. What on earth is going on here? And then it says the David Pakman Show shared content that was removed by Facebook because our technology detected that it goes against our community standards. I looked in my email and there was an email saying that we published hate speech. We published hate speech. I went through this process of requesting a review, and it's an endless loop where when you click request, it then just tells you, do you want to request another review? Clearly, some algorithm has determined that we published hate speech, and even the mechanism to request a review is an endless loop. So what I'm asking you for is we need a contact. We need some real person. If you know someone who works at Facebook or Meta, if you I don't know, but this was about 17% of our revenue. It's now gone to zero. This is really a problem. And by the way, I'm not legally arguing Facebook is doing anything wrong. An algorithm wrongly identified what was probably me debunking hate speech as publishing hate speech. They're going after the wrong people by their own terms of service. If they decided we don't want progressive content, it would be within their legal right to do it. I'm not making a legal argument. I'm making an argument that these algorithms are actually not hurting conservatives. They're hurting people like us on the left. So certainly, if you're able to help us replace this lost revenue by getting a membership at joinpacman.com, everybody at the show would appreciate it. Just as importantly, if you can help get us in touch with a real person at Facebook to help us out with this, we would be so grateful. Email info@davidpacman.com if you have a friend, family member, father.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
One thing is clear. Under international humanitarian law, health facilities, health workers, ambulances, and patients must be safeguarded and protected against all acts of war.
The World Health Organization condemns Israel's ongoing military raid of Al-Shifa, the largest hospital in Gaza, as the United Nations Security Council passes its first resolution calling for extended humanitarian pauses in Gaza. We'll look at the growing movement to hold Israel and its backers, including the United States, legally accountable for war crimes.
This is the mighty Israel, its might and power, targeting civilians. They are doing war crimes, crimes against humanity. Persecution for 2.4 million people.
We'll speak to four international human rights attorneys in Germany, in France, in the United States, and also Raji Sarani in Gaza, if we can reach him. Then we'll be joined by the niece of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. She's calling for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Dozens of Palestinians have been killed in a 41st consecutive day of unrelenting attacks by Israel's military on the Gaza Strip. Overnight, Israel's Air Force dropped leaflets over parts of the southern city of Khan Yunis, ordering people to leave their homes and shelters, quote, for their own safety. Many are being expelled for a second time, after Israel last month ordered more than 1 million Palestinians to leave their homes in northern Gaza. On Wednesday, Israeli authorities allowed the first shipment of fuel into the Gaza Strip since early October. The UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees, UNRWA, says just over 6,000 gallons of fuel, half a tanker truck's worth, was allowed to cross from Egypt. That's just 9% of what UNRWA says is needed daily to sustain life-saving activities. Israel's not allowing the fuel to be used in hospitals or to power water and sewage pumps. The UN's human rights chief, Volker Turk, said outbreaks of disease and hunger in Gaza now appear inevitable. His remarks came amidst a worsening humanitarian catastrophe at Gaza's largest hospital, Al-Shifa Medical Complex, which is being occupied by Israel's army. Thousands of patients, medical workers, and displaced Palestinians remain trapped inside the hospital, unable to leave. Medical workers report Israeli attacks have severely damaged Al-Shifa's main surgery building. About 200 people were reportedly blindfolded by Israeli troops and led away to interrogations. The World Health Organization's Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus says 26 out of Gaza's 36 hospitals are now closed due to damage from Israeli strikes or because they've run out of fuel.
Israel's military incursion into Al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza City is totally unacceptable. Hospitals are not battlegrounds.
Israel's military has displayed images of weapons they claim were found inside the hospital, but Hamas has dismissed the photos as propaganda. On Wednesday, the Israel Defense Forces published videos showing what they claimed were Hamas grab bags of rifles and grenades stashed inside the hospital. Doctors at Al-Shifa have repeatedly denied such claims. President Biden has repeated Israeli claims about Hamas using hospitals as military bases. Biden spoke to reporters from California Wednesday evening after wrapping APEC, the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Summit, in San Francisco.
You have a circumstance where the first war crime is being committed by Hamas by having their headquarters, their military, hidden under a hospital. And that's a fact. That's what's happened.
President Biden provided no evidence for the claim. His remarks came after a meeting with Chinese President Xi Jinping at the APEC summit. The pair emerged with several agreements, including one to reestablish military communications and one curbing the Chinese export of chemicals used for the production of fentanyl. On Wednesday evening, Xi Jinping mingled with leaders of corporate America, including Elon Musk and Apple CEO Tim Cook, at a lavish reception. Hours after their meeting, Biden ratcheted up tensions with China when he called President Xi a dictator.
I mean, he's a dictator in the sense that he is a guy who runs a country that is a communist country that's based on a form of government totally different than ours. Anyway.
Earlier today, Beijing responded to Biden's remarks, calling them, quote, irresponsible political manipulation. The United Nations Security Council has passed a resolution calling for urgent and extended humanitarian pauses and corridors throughout the Gaza Strip. The measure was approved by a 12-0 vote after the United States, United Kingdom, and Russia abstained. Four prior attempts by the Council to pass resolutions calling for ceasefires or so-called humanitarian pauses were vetoed by the United States. Daily protests against Israel's attack on Gaza continue. In Washington, D.C., human rights activists gathered in front of the White House for a vigil calling on President Biden to back an immediate ceasefire. Body bags were laid out on the ground to represent the more than 11,500 Palestinians killed by the U.S.-backed Israeli assault. Later in the evening, activists blocked the entrance of the Democratic National Committee headquarters before police violently removed them. Lawmakers, including House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries, were gathered for a campaign event inside. This is Eva Bugwort of the Jewish Peace Group, If Not Now. Interview was interrupted when police resumed beating protesters, spraying them with chemical agents, and arresting them. In Los Angeles, over 1,000 American Jews and others held an emergency sit-in on one of Hollywood's busiest streets to demand an immediate ceasefire. Earlier this week, over 700 Jewish activists and their allies shut down Oakland's federal building. Hundreds of people were arrested in the action. At the prestigious National Book Awards ceremony last night, 20 of the 25 nominated authors made a collective statement on stage calling for a ceasefire. This is the author, Alia Bilal.
On behalf of the finalists, we oppose the ongoing bombardment of Gaza and call for a humanitarian ceasefire to address the urgent humanitarian needs of Palestinian civilians, particularly children. We oppose anti-Semitism and anti-Palestinian sentiment and Islamophobia equally, accepting the human dignity of all parties, knowing that further bloodshed does nothing to secure lasting peace.
One of the New York City event's sponsors, Zibi Media, withdrew its support ahead of the prize ceremony after learning of the author's plan to speak out against the war. Meanwhile, Black Christian faith leaders have been meeting with White House officials and members of the Congressional Black Caucus to call for an end to the violence. Last week, over 900 Black faith leaders representing churches across the U.S. took out a full-page ad in the New York Times to call for a ceasefire and a commitment to a meaningful peace process. 24 members of the House of Representatives have signed a joint letter calling on President Biden to press for a bilateral ceasefire in Gaza on the basis of grave violations of children's rights. The letter was authored by Democratic Congress members Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez of New York, Mark Pocan of Wisconsin, and Betty McCollum of Minnesota. This comes as the powerful lobby group AIPAC, that's the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, steps up its support for primary challengers to lawmakers who voice support for a ceasefire. Slate magazine reports AIPAC is expected to spend $100 million in Democratic primaries backing opponents of House progressives. The Senate's approved a short-term funding bill to keep the government open until early 2024, sending the measure to President Biden for a signature ahead of a midnight deadline Friday to avert a government shutdown. Its passage on Wednesday came as far-right members of the House of Representatives rebelled against Republican Speaker Mike Johnson to punish party leaders for crafting a compromise bill with Democrats. The rebellion prompted Speaker Johnson to abruptly adjourn the House until after the Thanksgiving holiday. In Texas, seven more women who were denied medically necessary abortions joined a lawsuit filed by the Center for Reproductive Rights against the state of Texas. There are now 22 plaintiffs as the case heads to the Texas Supreme Court later this month. The case seeks to clarify what constitutes a medical emergency, allowing for an abortion, and to permit doctors to make that call without fear of prosecution. One of the new plaintiffs is Danielle Matheson, who's an OBGYN who was forced to leave her home state just to get abortion care. Dr. Matheson said, quote, "Texas lawmakers know nothing about medicine, and they have created a full-blown public health crisis," unquote. In related news, a federal judge last week blocked an Idaho law which made it a crime to help a minor cross state lines for an abortion without parental consent. The judge says the law, signed in April by Republican Governor Brad Little, violated the First Amendment. This comes as the Justice Department backed two lawsuits challenging a similar law in Alabama. And in Ghana, African leaders have issued a collective call for reparations for the historic enslavement of people of African descent. Togo's Prime Minister, Victoire Tomega Dogbe, was one of the speakers during the two-day conference in Accra.
The psychological trauma inflicted by this abhorrent practice continues to resonate across generations, affecting our collective consciousness. Colonialism, with its arbitrary borders and economic exploitation, further reinforced racial hierarchies and sowed seeds of discord that persist to this day. The scars of exploitation, dispossession, and cultural erasure persist, manifesting themselves in contemporary challenges such as economic inequality, political instability, and cultural disintegration.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Nermeen Sheikh. Hi, Nermeen.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Israel's rejecting a United Nations Security Council call for urgent and extended humanitarian pauses in Gaza as Israel's bombardment of the besieged enclave continues for a 41st day. The UN Security Council passed the resolution by a vote of 12-0, with the United States, Britain, and Russia abstaining. It's the first resolution passed by the UN Security Council since Israel began its bombardment after the Hamas attack on Israel on October 7th. This comes as Israel's continuing its military raid on Al-Shifa, the largest hospital in Gaza. Israel's long claim Hamas placed a major command center underneath the hospital, but Israel has not shared any evidence of this so far. Israel's displayed images of weapons they claim were found inside the hospital, but Hamas has dismissed the photos as propaganda. On Wednesday, the Secretary General of the World Health Organization, Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, condemned the raid on Al-Shifa.
Israel's military incursion into Al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza City is totally unacceptable. Hospitals are not battlegrounds. We're extremely worried for the safety of staff and patients. Protecting them is paramount. WHO has lost contact with health workers at Al-Shifa Hospital. But one thing is clear. under international humanitarian law, health facilities, health workers, ambulances, and patients must be safeguarded and protected against all acts of war. Not only that, they must be actively protected during military planning.
As Israel rejects growing international calls for a ceasefire in Gaza, there are mounting efforts to hold Israel and its backers accountable for committing war crimes in Gaza. Here in the United States, the Center for Constitutional Rights has sued President Biden, accusing him of failing to prevent genocide. Today, CCR is seeking an emergency order to block Biden, as well as Secretary of State Antony Blinken and Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin, from providing further military funding, arms, and diplomatic support to Israel. We're joined now by Catherine Gallagher, senior attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights, one of the lawyers who brought the case. Catherine, can you lay out the case for us? What are you demanding of the U.S. government, of President Biden?
Morning, Amy. This case filed on Monday was filed on behalf of two Palestinian human rights organizations, Defense for Children International Palestine, Al-Haq, which is the oldest Palestinian human rights organization, which for the first time in its history is unable to do its work in Gaza because of the conditions, as well as three Palestinians in Gaza and five Palestinian American families who have members of their families killed, injured, and under direct threat right now in Gaza. We filed this case against President Biden, Secretary of State Blinken, and Secretary of State Austin with two claims. One is that they have absolutely and completely failed in their duty under international law and U.S. law to take all measures possible to prevent the unfolding genocide against the Palestinian population in Gaza. The United States is a signatory to the Genocide Convention, and in recognition of the severity that this is the crime of crimes when it requires the specific intent to destroy a group, a national or ethnic group, in whole or in part, that is such a serious crime that states are obligated to take all measures within their control, all measures possible, from the second, from the minute they learn of the possibility of genocide, to stop that. We have not seen the United States do that, despite its considerable influence over Israel in the form of hundreds of billions of dollars in military aid that it sent over the decades and billions in the past year. Instead of using that influence to stop the killing, to stop the imposition of a total siege, denying all basic necessities to 2.2 million people in the enclosed space of Gaza. They have rushed weapons. They have given unconditional political support up until yesterday when we saw a Security Council resolution not yet call for a complete ceasefire. The United States had blocked all measures at the international level. So we are bringing the first claim for its failure to prevent the unfolding genocide. And the second claim is that it's actually complicit in genocide. We lay out the case that Israel is actually committing genocide at this moment. And we are able to do so, unfortunately, it's with no pleasure that we say this, at this early moment because of the very clear statements of intent by Prime Minister Netanyahu, by his Minister of Defense, and other senior Israeli officials about their intentions against the entire population in Gaza. They have been clear that they see this, the people, the children of Gaza, as less than human, describing the population as monsters or human animals, and then taking away all of the basic necessities, food, fuel, water, electricity. We've certainly, as you just played, heard what has happened to the healthcare and medical facilities, bombed and invaded. And so in the face of all of this, the United States, when it has continued to send weapons, to send military advisors, to rush aid and give moral and political support to Israel's actions, we say it is aiding and abetting genocide.
And so, Catherine, could you, because it seems that there's some disagreement or dispute about whether what's taking place right now is a genocide or ethnic cleansing, even among scholars of genocide. So could you explain the distinction between the two and how it is that the people whom you've had advising you on this case are convinced that what's happening right now, not what is to come, what is unfolding right now is a genocide?
So just to first clarify, ethnic cleansing is actually not a crime. Ethnic cleansing is a description that is often used, whether for crimes against humanity, such as extermination or forcible transfer and deportation. And I want to be very clear, those in and of themselves are serious crimes. The International Criminal Court has jurisdiction over those crimes. And frankly, it should be bringing arrest warrants for those crimes at this moment. So that is the first point. As to why we believe it is a genocide, the elements of genocide are that specific intent to destroy in whole or in part a group, and then there are underlying acts for genocide. And we think three of the five underlying acts are present in this case: killing, causing serious bodily or mental harm, and creating the conditions of life intended to destroy a population in whole or in part. And so to unpack that a bit, what we have at the front end, and usually specific intent is something that needs to be determined and only able to be concluded after the fact. I worked at the Yugoslav War Crimes Tribunal on the Srebrenica cases, and I know how difficult even in that case it was to make the conclusion that it was genocide. Here, we have those statements up front, and what we have from the Israeli officials is backing up those statements to impose a total siege and deny an entire population the basic necessities of life, the access to, as I said, food, fuel, electricity, which are necessary for hospitals to run, for people to be able to make their food, for water. We are seeing the start of starvation happening. And of course, all of that has happened under intense and continual military bombardment of a space that has a blockade and closed borders. And that blockade has been in place for 16 years. And again, I would say that there have been crimes against humanity being committed against the Palestinian population in Gaza, at least throughout the entirety of that 16-year blockade. What we have seen now is the expression of specific intent to destroy that population. And that, with the killings that we have seen, already over well over 11,000 people have lost their lives, including over 4,600 children. We see that this is a campaign against the entire population. So for genocide, when you take that specific intent, as expressed by the senior Israeli officials who have the capacity to carry out those threats, and then the actions, and we are seeing that they are carrying out exactly what they promised, then you are able to make the case for genocide. And I just want to emphasize again that because of the seriousness of this crime of crimes, the duty to prevent kicks in as soon as a country is on notice of a serious risk of genocide. And the United States has been on notice since at least October 9th, when the Minister of Defense announced the total siege, which was then imposed, if not already on October 7th, when Prime Minister Netanyahu made threats to turn the entire Gaza Strip into rubble and to erase it off the earth. And so that is why we feel that that duty to prevent, if not already liability for complicity, is present. And what we need, we don't need to be quibbling about legal definitions at this moment. What we need is action. We need the President of the United States, the Secretary of State, and the Secretary of Defense to do what the vast majority of the world has been calling for weeks, and that is stop this killing, stop the siege on Gaza. Allow the 2.2 million people to live with dignity, to have their rights respected, and to not be subjected to this horror that we have all been witnessing and trying to do whatever we can to make the most powerful country on earth have some compassion and comply with the law.
Catherine Gallagher, we thank you for being with us, senior staff attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights, which is seeking an emergency order today to block President Biden, as well as Secretary of State Antony Blinken, Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin, from providing further military funding, arms and diplomatic support to Israel. Coming up, we go to France and Italy to speak with human rights attorneys, Germany and France, to hold Israel and its backers, including the U.S., legally accountable, and will try to reach a human rights attorney in Gaza. Stay with us.
مدو جزر القمر يلعب بخيوطي وارقص على لحن مش مسموع مشاعر شعري ما بتحس غبار تلمع نور الشمس بالغرفة
Toyor by Rasha Nahas and Dina Awadidi. Rasha Nahas is a Palestinian singer who held a concert Tuesday in Berlin, donating all proceeds to Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. As Israel rejects a United Nations Security Council resolution calling for urgent and extended humanitarian pauses in Gaza, we're continuing to look at growing efforts to hold Israel legally accountable for war crimes in Gaza. Joining us from Berlin, Germany, is Chantal Maloney. She is an international criminal lawyer, international criminal law professor at the University of Milan in Italy. She's also senior legal advisor for international crimes accountability with the European Center for Constitutional and Human Rights in Berlin. She also consults with the Palestinian Center for Human Rights and represents victims in Palestine before the International Criminal Court. She's the author of the book, Is There a Court for Gaza? Her new piece for Justice and Conflict is headlined, The War in Gaza, International Law is Nothing If It Is Not Applied. And with us in France is Reid Brody, longtime human rights attorney, war crimes prosecutor. Brody has been involved in several major war crimes cases, including against Chile's former dictator Augusto Pinochet, Haiti's Jean-Claude Baby Doc Duvalier, and the former Chadian dictator Hissène Habré. He's author of To Catch a Dictator, The Pursuit and Trial of Hissène Habré, and he's the son of a Hungarian Holocaust survivor. Reid's recent piece for The Nation is headlined, Gaza, Where is the Law? Chantal Maloney, let's begin with you. Where is the law? We are trying to reach a man you and Reid have worked closely with in Gaza, Raji Sarani, who lived in northern Gaza. His home was bombed, now forced to live in Khan Yunis. And now parts of Khan Yunis have been covered with leaflets saying that those who are there must move further south.
Yes, indeed. Well, first of all, thank you very much for having me with you today. I think that what we have witnessed in the past weeks, it's literally the commission on each and every international crime that you may find listed under the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court. And I was listening very carefully to what my colleague Katie Gallagher just said before, their very, very important legal action in the U.S. And, of course, she started to talk about the fact that Gaza is under blockade since 16 years. So I think we need to go back to 2007, and we need to go back to the first efforts that have been done already in 2009 to basically bring these violations and possible grave crimes to the jurisdiction of the International Criminal Court. So let's just remember that it was already in January 2009 that the Palestinian Authority, so to say, knocked on the door of the International Criminal Court, lodging an Article 15.3, so an ad hoc acceptance of the jurisdiction of the ICC, in order to have these grave crimes that had already been committed during the Operation Cast-Lead investigated and possibly prosecuted in The Hague. And I want to remember really the conclusions that already the UN fact-finding mission on the Gaza Strip, the so-called Goldstone Report, after the name of Richard Goldstone, the famous South African judge, had reached in 2009, meaning that the closure of the Gaza Strip that had been imposed continuously since 2007 was unlawful, collective punishment of the civilian population of Gaza, and a possible crime against humanity. The conclusions were in the sense of the commission of the crime of persecution, a very grave crime against humanity, exactly because there was this disproportionate collective punishment on an entire population, 2 million people of Gaza, with the declared purpose by the Israeli authorities to try to break their support to Hamas and therefore diminish their possibility, apparently, to commit anything that could be harmful for Israel. And already at that time, the fact-finding mission concluded that the series of acts that deprived the Palestinians in Gaza of their basic needs of subsistence, employment, housing, water, as well as, of course, their freedom of movement, amounted to collective punishment and possible crime against humanity. So what we have seen after that is a very long and protracted now denial of justice, because while we are talking, it is 14 years later, we are still in a phase where we don't see any concrete steps in The Hague at the ICC. The investigation is now formally open since 2021, but we have not seen any warrant of arrest nor any concrete action.
And Chantal, could you talk more about this issue of Israel's claim that they will take actions to make sure that Hamas does not pose a threat to Israel in any form? I just want to read a statement, because, of course, what we hear again and again in light of Hamas's attack on October 7th is that Israel has the right to self-defense. And I just want to read a statement that UN Special Rapporteur on the occupied Palestinian territories, Francesca Albanese, recently made. She says that Israel cannot, quote, claim the right of self-defense against a threat that emanates from the territory that it occupies, from a territory that is kept under belligerent occupation. So if you could explain that and what the distinction is between two things: the fact that it is a territory that is occupied by Israel, and second, that Hamas is, of course, not a state. It is a non-state actor that is considered by Israel, the U.S., the U.K., to be a terrorist organization. So what law applies in that case?
Yes, exactly. It is very important to understand what is the law, the legal framework that applies to this, because Gaza is still part of the occupied Palestinian territory, and Israel, regardless of the disengagement, so the occupation changed its form in the Gaza Strip since 2006, but it didn't change substance, meaning that Israel is still exercising effective control on the Gaza Strip and its entire population by different means, not anymore with boots on the ground, but rather through controlling its borders, its aerial space, its sea, and of course also the civilian life. We have to remember that even the civilian registries in Gaza are still basically kept by the Israeli authorities. And as you know, of course, no one gets in and out of Gaza, not even the UN functionaries, not even international experts comes into Gaza if Israel do not allow this from happening. So this is why not the Palestinians, but also international bodies, the ICRC, the UN, have considered, and also the International Criminal Court, that Gaza is still occupied territory. This means that Israel bears very specific duties and responsibilities with regard to the civilian population of Gaza. Not only they should not harm them, they should actually protect them. So what we are witnessing in these weeks, but honestly what we have witnessed in particular since 2007 on, it's a violation, a grave violation of international humanitarian law, also taking into account the very strong duty that is placed on Israel as occupying power. With regard to the specific question you were making, you were asking me about whether Israel can rely or not on self-defense with regard to Gaza and with regard to Hamas, not being Hamas a state, but an armed group that is considered to be a terrorist group internationally. So I don't think, honestly, that this is the most important legal point to be disentangled. It is a very complex legal point, but it is only, if you want, it is only relevant if we want to discuss whether Israel's reaction to the grave crimes committed by Hamas on the 7th of October is an act of aggression or not. The point is that regardless of what we think in this regard, and I personally think that what Francesca Albanese, the UN Special Rapporteur, is arguing is absolutely reasonable and can be the line to be followed. But regardless of whether we agree with her and with other legal scholars on this point, the issue is that the response, what Israel is doing after the 7th of October in Gaza is in grave violations of international humanitarian law, meaning the law, the rules that regulate war, the armed conflict. And so this is, for me, the most important point to make, regardless of the legitimacy or not of the intervention. We are witnessing very grave crimes that can be analyzed under the lenses of war crimes, of crimes against humanity, or, as we heard from Katie Gallagher and the CCR, genocide.
Reid Brody, I'd like to bring you into the conversation. You wrote this piece for The Nation called Gaza, Where is the Law? If you could lay out the argument you make in that piece and the background that you give about the role in particular of the International Criminal Court in the past in prosecuting or not prosecuting crimes that Israel was accused of.
Sure. I mean, as Chantal was saying, every attempt by Palestinians, by Raji and others, to use the International Criminal Court and other institutions of international justice to hold Israeli officials legally accountable has been sidelined or delegitimized as lawfare. I mean, as Chantal has said, the ICC really subjected the Palestinian complaints to this obstacle course over 15 years, to the point that in all of that time, there has been no charges have ever been brought. And this includes the things that, I mean, we're talking the decades of Israeli occupation, the collective punishment, the apartheid, the war crimes that were, but the illegal settlements. Settlements are illegal under international law to bring your people into an occupied territory. And they have been given the go slow treatment. First, it was the question of whether they were a state. The first prosecutor kicked the ball, spent 3 years looking at it and kicked the ball down the road. Fatou Bensouda, the second prosecutor, spent 5 years conducting a preliminary examination before assuring that there was that there were grounds to believe that both Israel and Palestinians had committed crimes, including the settlements, including war crimes. And then she left it to the current prosecutor, Karim Khan. When the invasion, when the Russian invasion, compare this to the Russian, so 15 years of no action. You compare this to the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Right after the Russian invasion, it was the war crimes started to mount. The International Criminal Court and most of the Western justice systems did what they were supposed to do. Immediately, Karim Khan went to Ukraine, talked about it as a crime scene, raised an enormous amount of money for the ICC's investigation, and has already, in fact, issued an arrest warrant against Vladimir Putin. For the transfer of Ukrainian children. Compare that then to Palestine, where none of this has happened. Now, we did see, and I think this is important, last week the prosecutor Karim Khan, who has been, you know, criticized for not doing anything, for not moving, went finally to the Rafah crossing. He followed it up with a very powerful speech from Cairo, in which he spoke, you know, he spoke about the crimes that were, or he spoke about the allegations on both sides. He spoke very bluntly in a way to the Israeli authorities. He reminded them that the conduct of the conflict has to respect the laws of war, distinction between civilian population and military objects, proportionality, precaution. I think, as we can talk about, I mean, I think these are not being honored. But it was very clear to Israel that mosques, that churches, that houses, that hospitals have a protected status, and that it is the—that the burden is on the— as he put it, those who fire the gun or the rocket or the missile to show that they've lost their protective status. Will this be followed up by real action for the first time? I mean, as many people have pointed out, the fact that there was no accountability for the last decades of occupation and crimes related to the occupation has created a sense of impunity. Are we going to finally deal with that sense of impunity?
On Wednesday, Israel's deputy UN ambassador, Jonathan Miller, claimed Israel always adheres to international law. This is what he said.
Hamas is solely responsible for the humanitarian situation in Gaza, and they weaponized it to prevent Israel from defending itself. Israel does not need a resolution to remind us to adhere to international law. Israel always adheres to international law.
So that's Israel's deputy UN ambassador, Jonathan Miller. Reid, if you could respond to that and also talk about investigation of Hamas for war crimes.
Sure. I mean, you know, the core principles, as everyone should know, regarding the laws of war is the protection of civilians. Military operations can't be directed at civilians. And that's expressed through the principle of distinction. You have to make a distinction between civilian objects and military objects. Even—and this is, you know, like in the hospital case, even where you say that there is a military objective there, the leaders still have to act with proportionality. They cannot just go and, you know, and attack civilians in a way that is disproportionate. And One can argue about what disproportionate means under the law. It's where that an action is expected to cause incidental loss of civilian life, injury to civilians, that is excessive in relation to the military advantage that's anticipated. It's very hard to see, as we look at this conflict today, the 10,000 people who have been killed, 4,600 children, how these things are considered proportion. I think Israel has a heavy burden to bear here to show in any way that these actions fit within the laws of the war. You brought up Hamas's crimes, and I think we all believe and that Hamas on October 7th committed very serious war crimes, probably crimes against humanity. Just as the decades of crimes under Israeli occupation do not justify Hamas committing crimes against civilians, committing war crimes, those crimes by Hamas cannot in any way justify further war crimes and many of the actions that are being undertaken by the Israeli armed forces today.
And finally, Reid, you are the son of a Holocaust survivor, a Hungarian forced laborer. Can you talk about what this means to you? You're in France. You live in Barcelona, Spain. The issue of increased anti-Semitism, and then also the equation of the criticizing of the Israeli state with anti-Semitism.
Well, those are a lot of questions to unpack. It's very difficult. I mean, I was with Chantal, actually, in Germany last week, where it's very, very difficult to criticize the conduct of Israel, where the line is very thin. And as somebody who spent half my life in Europe, I'm also aware of how prevalent anti-Semitism is and how much and how careful we have to be not to allow criticisms of Israel to spill over anti-Semitism and to be to be ruthless when we hear anti-Semitism. I come to my positions as an international lawyer, as a Jew, as the son of a Holocaust survivor. I don't think that these things can be conducted in my name, certainly. Obviously, in America and around the world, there are many Jews who have stood up and talked about not in our name. In Europe, it's quite—I have to say, in Spain, where I live, there are a lot fewer, and it's quite a big deal. But next week, there's a rally in Paris by Jews who are against what Israel is doing. I think more and more, this is becoming this is a question of humanity. One Holocaust does not justify another. This is what happened to my father's generation, to my father, to members of my family, was a genocide. But just like war crimes don't justify other war crimes, there's an asymmetrism between what happened with the Jews and what is happening today. And I don't think we can invoke the Holocaust, we can invoke what happened to our parents to allow Israel to commit war crimes today.
And Chantal, finally, we just have 1 minute, but if you could say whether the fact that Hamas has taken over 200 hostages, 240 Israeli hostages into Gaza, what effect that has, what impact, whether there's any allowance or what international law says can be done in the event of a hostage taking on this scale in terms of the return of the hostages?
I mean, if I understand correctly your question, of course, also what Hamas did with regard to the hostage taking from Israeli civilians can amount to war crimes, is a violation of the rules of international humanitarian law, and it follows potentially under the jurisdiction of the... What we really... And I think we will see an acceleration in the investigations of the International Criminal are so dramatic. So, and I'm sure that the prosecutor will analyze 360 degrees responsibilities, meaning both the Israeli authorities and the Palestinian armed groups. But what we really urgently need is accountability and to break this circle of impunity, which fosters violence and has been already for too long denounced in this way as one of the triggers of the violence and brutality that we are witnessing today.
Chantal Maloney, we want to thank you so much for being with us, international criminal lawyer, consulted with the Palestinian Center for Human Rights and represents victims in Palestine before the International Criminal Court. And Reid Brody, human rights attorney and war crimes prosecutor, son of a Hungarian Holocaust survivor. When we come back, we'll be joined by the niece of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. She's calling for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza. Back in 20 seconds. لكل أطفال الحجارة الذين ذاقوا المرارة لا تهاب النار ولا تخشوا الجدار بل ثوروا كاتشي جفارا وكونوا أنتم الشرارة أحييكم بحرارة أبطال بجدارة وكونوا أنتم الشرارة. Che Guevara by Palestinian singer Amal Mercus. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. We spend the rest of the hour with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's niece, a Providence College political science professor and Middle East expert. She's the niece of Netanyahu's wife, Sarah Netanyahu. This month, she was one of the signatories to a letter from Jewish and Israeli residents of Rhode Island that asks the state's federal delegation to support ceasefire in Gaza. In March, Ruth Ben-Artzi spoke out about distancing herself from all contact with the prime minister's family. When asked by the Israeli newspaper Haaretz why she chose to speak out, she said, quote, "The answer is that I'm ashamed, sad, and angry. Ashamed that my relatives have no shame, that they're in a position of power that promotes and encourages violence, racism, nationalism, and fascism. These are not the Jewish values I absorbed and to which I feel connected. Israel could remain a country in which Jews find a safe and free haven of equality and partnership with all the population groups within the state's borders." Well, Professor Ruth Ben-Artzi joins us now, again, a Providence College political science professor and Middle East expert. She's an Israeli and U.S. citizen. We welcome you to Democracy Now! Thank you so much for being with us. Your voice has so much power because you are the prime minister's niece. Can you speak directly to him, to the people of Palestine and Israel and the world, about what you want to see happen right now, Ruth Ben-Artzi?
So I, first of all, speak as an Israeli citizen, as an American citizen, as a person who is observing everything that is happening with my experience having grown up in Israel, and also as a political scientist who studies and researches these issues for many, many years now. From all of those different perspectives, I come to this realization we came to this decision that a ceasefire is really the only way that any solution can ever be achieved. I think that the continued violence that begets violence is only going to bring us further away from a solution to the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. It's really important to remember that we've been hearing also from policymakers, from American policymakers, and even from Israeli policymakers, military experts, that there's no military solution for the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And if there's no military solution to the conflict, there's no military way to eradicate Hamas as well. The more harm that we're inflicting, the more violence that is occurring, whatever anybody wants to as a backdrop to either justify it or to explain it, does not make sense for the future. It only brings us further away from finding that solution, from being able to move towards that political solution. And it's clear that the day that this war is over is going to be the day that a political solution is going to have to start to be implemented. The occupation, the siege in the West Bank, the siege in Gaza that happened until October 7th, all of these we traditionally call status quo, but it's not really status quo because things are changing. The population is changing, the demographics are changing, the infrastructure is changing over all of these years of occupation. That can't continue. The management of the conflict that has been the policy of the Israeli government, at least since 2009, was never going to work, and it has no long-term prospects. The ceasefire is the only. We're seeing the numbers of innocent civilians who are caught in the crossfires, the number of those who are victims of this war grow every single minute, and that is in addition to the humanitarian. All the humanitarian concerns that and the experts that you had on the show before me, the legal concerns. In addition to that, that also brings us further away from being able to implement the kinds of policies that we need to implement the day after the war.
Professor Ben-Akhti, you've also, like many, of course, expressed concern about the well-being of the hostages who are in Gaza still, about 240 of them. If you could talk about how you think a ceasefire might make it possible for their safe return. I mean, it was just reported that Israel and Hamas appear close to an agreement whereby 50 women and children, Israeli civilians, would be released in return for 50 Palestinian women and children prisoners being freed. So if you could talk about the impact a ceasefire may have on the release of the Israeli civilian hostages in Gaza.
Right. So in Jewish tradition, we have a tradition that is called Pidyon Shvuim, which means that the release of the hostages comes first and at all costs. And that is to save lives. The bombing of Gaza, those hostages are in Gaza. When Gaza is being bombed, when we don't know where those hostages are, it puts them in danger too. There's going to be a day, there's come a judgment for Hamas and for those who have inflicted the horrible violence on Israel on October 7th. But right now, the focus has to be the release of those hostages, and the bombing that is clearly not very specifically targeted and is putting those hostages in harm's way is only exacerbating the situation and including the Rhode Islanders who signed this letter. I've also joined hundreds of political scientists who signed a letter to demand immediate ceasefire for some of those same strategic reasons, humanitarian reasons, and also for what is for me in the front of my mind, the release of the hostages. We buried today a peace activist who was murdered on October 7th, who had spent decades in activism trying to help to bring a solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and continuing that tradition. There's Israelis who are continuing that tradition. There's Israelis in Israel now and abroad. There's organizations, both Palestinian and Jewish organizations, that are working towards that solution, to find a peaceful solution, and to bring the hostages back. We have to have those negotiations, and if the negotiations have to happen with the group, with the terrorist group that is holding those hostages, there's no other way. There's no other solution for this. Get the hostages out. This is what the hostages are demanding, and then we can continue the political work of rehabilitating Gaza, removing Hamas from power, and finding a political solution, which is really the only way that the roughly 7 million Jews and 7 million Palestinians who live between the river and the sea will ever be able to find peace.
Professor Ben-Artzi, we just have 30 seconds, but as the niece of the Israeli Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, have the two senators from Rhode Island spoken to you, Jack Reed and Sheldon Whitehouse, or Seth Magaziner and Gabe Amo, the Congress members?
As Rhode Islanders, we speak to our delegation all the time. Our group that signed this letter and that sent them this letter spoke to our delegation. We're in contact all the time. We have various connections in their small state. And I think that we have a listening ear to all the different voices that are heard.
We have to leave it there. We thank you so much, Providence College political science professor Ruth Ben-Artzi, the daughter of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. I'm Amy Goodman-Nermin-Sheikh.
Counterfeit products, think again. You're smart, buy smart. Go for real. Learn more at McGruffPSA.org. This message is brought to you by the United States Patent and Trademark Office and the National Crime Prevention Council.
Everybody ready?
Hello there, everybody, and welcome to another exciting episode of Whiskey Before Breakfast or the Roots Program, depending on where you are located. I am Mando Richard, and I've got a great couple of hours of music here for you. We'll start off on the liquored up side of the family, like we usually do. We'll close down on the gospel side, and in between, we've got a lot of great music that I know you will enjoy. Let's just go ahead and get things started, shall we? Silly me, I couldn't remember what I had up first. This is going to be Tom T. Hall starting off a set about beer.
In some of my songs, I have casually mentioned the fact that I like to drink beer. This little song is more to the point. Roll out the barrel and lend me your ears. I like beer. It makes me a jolly good fellow. I like beer. It helps me unwind, and sometimes it makes me feel mellow.
Makes him feel mellow.
Whiskey's too rough, champagne costs too much. Vodka puts my mouth in gear. This little refrain should help me explain. As a matter of fact, I like beer.
He likes beer.
My wife often frowns when we're out on the town and I'm wearing a suit and a tie. She's sipping vermouth and she thinks I'm uncouth when I yell as the waiter goes by. I like beer.
It makes me a jolly good fellow.
I like beer. It helps me unwind, and sometimes it makes me feel mellow.
Makes him feel mellow.
Whiskey's too
champagne costs too much. Vodka puts my mouth in gear. While this little refrain should help me explain, as a matter of fact, I like beer.
He likes beer.
Last night I dreamed that I passed from the scene, and I went to a place so sublime. All the water was clear and tasted like beer. Then they turned it all into wine. I like beer. It makes me a jolly good fellow. I like beer. It helps me unwind, and sometimes it makes me feel mellow.
Makes him feel mellow.
Whiskey's too rough, champagne costs too much, vodka puts my mouth in gear. All this little refrain should help me explain, as a matter of fact, I love beer.
Yeah!